So I want to talk today about a project that actually got started 4 years ago when I was teaching stellar structure at Berkeley and gave a very hard homework problem, which ended up becoming a research project and was rather fruitful. So what I'm going to talk about today is lithium burning in low-mass main sequence stars. And this is work done with Ed Brown, who's now a postdoc at Chicago, Chris Matzner, who's now a postdoc at CETA, and Greg Ushimirsky, who's now a postdoc at Caltech. These are all students in my stellar structure course who stuck it out past the homework problem to actually turn it into some science. So I want to start by giving you some very simple basics of pre-main sequence stars and stellar contraction, remind you of the story of the first element that gets burned in stars, which is deuterium, and then discuss a very simple approach to understanding the thermonuclear destruction of lithium-7, which actually is so simple that it ends up being, and that's the main part of the talk, the physics is so clear and simple that it actually ends up being a rather robust way to date open clusters, to find the age of open clusters. And I'll show you that and explain why that is. This has actually been carried out now for three different clusters, and I'll show you the results from the hard work of many observers, mostly using Keck, to use this technique so as to date clusters. And I think the interesting thing, probably specifically for this audience, is the comparison of these ages from pre-main sequence stars to the ages you get from the upper main sequence turnoff, and the fact that the discrepancies from these pretty much, I think, make the case clear that convective overshoot, something that's been discussed for years, and I'll discuss what that is, that there's a very clear need for that in main sequence interiors. This also has a pretty big effect on the white dwarf initial mass, final mass relation, and I'll close by showing that as well. So let me talk about the Pleiades, and let me first just sort of remind you to set the stage what I'm talking about. This is a theorist version of the HR diagram for the Pleiades, and I'm showing you schematically different things I'm going to talk about today. So this is temperature, obviously luminosity. Here's, say, the zero-age main sequence. Pleiades is about 100 million years old, and if you look at the Pleiades, what you see are low-mass stars, which are actually not yet even on the main sequence, high-mass stars, which have already left the main sequence, and stars of about 5 solar masses that are leaving the main sequence today. The more massive stars are already done. One of those more massive stars made a white dwarf 50 million years ago. There's one white dwarf known in the Pleiades, the age of which is 50 million years. The traditional age of getting open clusters is basically taking this turnoff, thinking you understand well the main sequence lifetime of a given luminosity, and getting the age by finding the brightest such star. That's the traditional way. That's what you'll see in the textbooks. What I want to talk about today is a way to get the ages from down here, and more interestingly is how do these two compare. Now you should stop and interrupt anytime. So what I'm going to talk about today are sort of very special stars, very simple stars, ones that are fully convective. And what I mean by that are stars for which accretion is pretty much shut off. So they are typically at least 5 or 10 million years old. And this is really the conventional Hayashi contraction. And at this point, the star is quite simple. It's fully convective, and we presume fully mixed. The rough idea of the mixing time, and this is just from calculating the efficiency of convection, is say 10 to 1,000 years. It's in hydrostatic balance. It's a nearly ideal gas. The energy transport is all via convection, and the profile is actually nearly adiabatic. This is the background star that actually makes these calculations simple, and I'll describe those as we go along. The issue, of course, is there must be a photosphere on these objects. That was what Hayashi made very clear, is the only way to understand these objects is to figure out how to attach a photosphere to that fully adiabatic profile. And let me give you the simple version of this from a review article by Steve Stoller. This is in PASP in 94. And this gives you a rough idea of how things scale. So you basically are going to have to match the entropy at the center with that at the photosphere. The photosphere of the star is, of course, where the optical depth's unity, where the optical depth is just the integral of the opacity kappa times rho dz from some position r out to infinity. And that's roughly just, if kappa is a constant, is roughly just kappa times the pressure of the photosphere divided by gravity, integral of rho dz from hydrostatic balance we know is just the pressure over gravity. So this is the optical depth, and we need to have a photosphere, otherwise this thing won't radiate. And so if we set this quantity to 1, that defines the photosphere, and that's sort of the conventional definition. Okay, that's part 1. Part 2 is the entropy is a constant through the star. So to make the entropy constant, if it's an ideal gas, that's just the same as the T over P to the 2/5 is a constant. In which case, I just match the effective temperature divided by the pressure of the photosphere to the 2/5 equal to the central temperature divided by the central pressure to the 2/5. Okay, so now I've got this equation, and I have this equation, and if I have an equation for kappa, I can then get the effective temperature. And when you're dominated by H minus, which is the predominant ion for these low temperature atmospheres, which are around 3,000 Kelvin, in some sense, from sort of a naive scaling from using the Saha equation, you get such a dependence, a very strong temperature dependence, that really is coming from the Saha equation. But you work through the algebra, and what you find is something like this, that the effective temperatures of those stars is proportional to the mass to the 1/7 and the radius to the 1/49, say. Namely, and the reason I want to make this point is that the effective temperatures of these stars, and this you know from, as I'll show you from just looking at basically the effective temperatures of these stars are pretty much independent of their radii. Okay? They fall down the Hayashi track at constant effective temperature, and that ends up being very important. Here's examples of this from, say, D'Antonio Mazzatelli. Again, this is luminosity effective temperature. The blue line here is the zero-age main sequence. I'm going to be talking today about stars. So these are the tracks of individual stars as they come down. Again, as you can see, they fall down nearly straight. They turn, say this is a 0.9 solar mass star. They turn from this track when the core becomes radiated. Eventually, the heat transport's adequate from just radiative heat transport. The heat can be carried in the interior of the star via radiation, and you break off from this track and you follow a very different track. Actually, the old tracks that have been calculated before Hayashi came along that put stars over here. Okay. All right. Now, the work that's being done at low-mass stars is trying to actually calculate this using the real physical opacities, really trying to get the effective temperature as a function of the mass and the radius. And that is complex and delicate activity. And what I'm going to show you today is that from the presumption that it doesn't depend on radius, that it's weakly dependent on radius, which is pretty much what everybody agrees, we will just presume that the effective temperature is in some sense some function of mass, and that since this is the observable, we're going to get M, as I'll show you later, we'll actually get M of the star, and the observer's measure T effective. So theoretically speaking, this is not well in hand. You can go find three different papers which will give you very different numbers from the theory side. But what I'll show you is that the results of the lithium burning actually allow you to measure the mass separately from the effective temperature. The important point is that these are always almost all independent of radius. So they might disagree on the scale, but they don't disagree on the independence to the radius. Okay. So that's sort of the simple basics of the contraction towards the main sequence. And what I want to talk about now is which light elements get burned and when. Okay. So first, just to set the stage, let me remind you of what the typical central temperatures are when you're on the main sequence and doing hydrogen burning. And for the range of masses I'm going to discuss today, up to one solar mass down to about 0.08, the Brown dwarf limit, that central range is from 3 to 10 by 10 to the 6, so the sun's around 10 to the 7. However, at these temperatures, or actually below these temperatures, some elements get burned. So you get to burn some things before you actually reach temperatures high enough to have the star live on hydrogen burning. Well, the first one to go is deuterium, and the reason for that is pretty simple. There's a low Coulomb barrier, but more importantly, it's just a purely strong reaction. I just take a proton, add it onto deuterium, and make helium-3. When does this happen? It happens when the lifetime of the deuterium nucleus to this reaction, to the P-gamma reaction, which is just given by the reaction rate and the proton density, roughly this happens when this time is comparable to the contraction time, the rate at which the star is contracting. At that point, that's when the abundance will suddenly drop. When does that happen? Well, deuterium burns when the central temperature is not even yet a million Kelvin, and the star is only about a million years old. Okay. And deuterium burning is kind of curious. It's one of these coincidences that is anti-anthropic, maybe. So you don't hear about it. It's probably somewhere in these books. I don't know. Somebody's read Barrow and Tipler. There is a coincidence. It's not an adequate coincidence, but it's an interesting one, and that's the following. This reaction releases 5 MeV of energy. The abundance of deuterium in the interstellar medium, which is pretty much set by the Big Bang, is about 2 by 10 to the minus 5. And so per proton, so if you ask how much energy is deposited in the plasma, it's about 100 EV per proton. Namely, when you burn the deuterium, you add energy into the plasma that sort of doubles KT. It's comparable to the thermal content. That's the coincidence. And so you actually halt contraction for a little bit. So as the star is contracting, it's always radiating. It's contracting because it has to release the gravitational energy to match the luminosity. But when the deuterium burns, that actually releases a bit of energy, so contraction is halted for a short while. Okay? But only for about one contraction time. So there is a deuterium main sequence, but it only lives for about a million years. Okay, so if the deuterium abundance was a factor of 100 higher, it would be, you know, life would be much more interesting. And some have made the case, and again, this is from Steve Stahl. This is the place on the HR diagram where that occurs, is that there does seem to be something connected with the contraction of these objects, the halting of that contraction for a few contraction times in the place in which you see the star. So some people would claim this is actually the birth line. And you have to be, another point to say, is that you have to be bigger than about 13 Jupiter masses to actually burn your deuterium. So Jupiter, for example, did not burn its deuterium during contraction. All right, so that's deuterium. The next element of interest is lithium, and that's the one I'm going to sort of get stuck on the rest of today. And there's two isotopes, lithium-6 and lithium-7. I'm going to focus on lithium-7. And it depletes, again, via just a proton reaction. It's a strong reaction that just makes helium-4. However, the abundance is so low, lithium to hydrogen in the ISM is about 10 to the minus 9, that you don't get to live on it, so the burning of that element doesn't do anything for you at all. However, the advantage is that it's actually very easy to observe lithium, and that's why this is an interesting game. And the hypothesis that everything's constructed on is that the full mixing implies that depletion at the surface is going to occur once your reaction starts at the center of the star. Namely, the burning is occurring at the center, and the presumption is, and I'll show you that there's evidence that supports this, is that the full mixing is really full mixing, and that when the star has started to burn it at the center, it's being depleted everywhere throughout the star. Okay. Now, which stars do I want to talk about? I'm going to today talk about the easy ones, aka not the sun. Okay? I want to talk about stars that are less than about 0.5 solar masses, and the reason is that those objects deplete the lithium while they're still fully convective. Okay? Stars more massive than that do deplete their lithium before they reach the main sequence, but they only do it after the core has become radiated. And in that case, then, if you want to understand the depletion of the lithium at the surface, you have to know where the base of that boundary of the convective zone resides. And to know that, you've got to know the opacity quite well. And so there are a stream of papers, which I can point you to, for about 25 years, of trying to understand lithium depletion in these objects, and it's very sensitive to many things you can worry about. For example, convective overshoot, even in that case. But more importantly, it actually depends quite a bit on what the opacities are. So in this case, there's a much more sensitivity to things we don't know. And the case I want to make today is that for the stars that deplete their lithium while they're still fully convective, the theory is actually quite robust. Okay. So let me see if there are questions. Yeah. Boy, for A stars, I mean, so definitely on the main sequence, there's no lithium at the center, but you're asking more for the surface abundance. I mean, that material, those, you know, for a 2 solar mass star, it becomes radiated quite early. I don't know, do you know, Jean-Paul? For A stars?
Only to balance that.
Yeah.
I think the dust line is where the star appears. It gets
Right, right. The contraction time is very short, too.
So this has to be your first day.
Right.
And therefore, the dust line intersects the track where the star is already radiating.
Yeah.
It's the horizontal
part. Right, right. So that's right. So they emerge on the radiated part already. So the core has already become radiated. So I don't have.
So they have the literally.
Yeah, that's right. So
they should have the
I think so.
On the left of the so-called lithium gap,
they have
on the blue side.
Yeah. Okay. So how do we calculate this? Well, this star is your textbook star in the sense that you can do a homework problem. That was my presumption. when I assigned it, I was criticized. Some students thought it was a little bit over the top. So it's an n equals 3s polytrope, namely p goes as rho to the 5/3, so we can write down the central density, central temperature, and unit in terms of the mass and the radius, the current mass and radius, and the mean molecular weight. The mean molecular weight basically allows you, so if it were non-degenerate, the mean molecular weight's just that, but because of degeneracy of the electrons, which can happen for very low mass objects near the brown dwarf limit, the pressure is higher than you'd expect, and so you can write down some effective degeneracy. What happens to these objects? Well, they're very simple. They radiate and lose energy at that rate, whereas I said, T effective, we're going to presume, is a constant for a given star as a function of time. And that's just living off of the gravitational contraction energy. And so you can integrate this and find the time it takes you to reach so that the central temperatures reach some value, Tc. And again, just to set the numbers, for around 3,000 Kelvin, which is typical for these stars, and a tenth of a solar mass object, to reach a central temperature of 3 million Kelvin, which is about where lithiums burn, as I'll show you, takes about 100 million years. Okay, so the number to keep in mind is that 100 million years, a tenth of a solar mass star is burning its lithium. And it's not even yet reached the main sequence. All right. Well, when does the depletion occur? Again, I'm going to walk you through the simple thing first and then show you the results from the more full calculation. Again, here's the same thing again. The contraction time is a function of T effective and central temperature. And the presumption is pretty much that because of the strong temperature sensitivity of the nuclear reactions, that all we have to really do to get a simple understanding is compare the nuclear destruction time to the contraction time. So the object's contracting, and that's really a power law on time. Okay? But the extremely strong temperature sensitivity of the nuclear burning means that this destruction time actually falls like a rock with temperature as the temperature is rising. That's what it is. So schematically, it looks like the following. If I plot the time scales as a function, in this case, of the central temperature. So as the star is contracting, the central temperature is rising, so it's moving to the right, and the contraction time is actually taking longer. So the time it takes to sort of have the radius as a function of central temperature is the green line. But the lithium destruction time scale is going like 1 over Tc to the 20th. Okay. And so this intersection point is actually very well defined. The temperature is very well defined. And that ends up being a huge advantage because it means you take the 1/20th root of all your approximations. Okay. So if you equate these two timescales, again, this gives you the typical number of 3 million Kelvin. And as I said, this big advantage of the temperature sensitivity of the burning means that you can actually do things pretty crudely, though we didn't do it that crudely. But what do you find? So what you find is the temperature at the time you deplete that scales with the mass to the 1/8 power and the effective temperature to the 1/6. Namely, it's there is a slight dependence on the mass and almost no dependence on the effective temperature. Since the temperature, just in the virial theorem, it relates to m over r, you can ask at what radius you have to be at, and that then goes as mass to the 7/8 t effective to the minus 1/6. Now, in reality, we did things more carefully, and I'll show you the results for that. When does this break down? This is a very simple story. It breaks down when the stars start to become degenerate. And so there actually is a lower mass limit for lithium burning, just as there's a lower mass limit for hydrogen burning. So if I were to show it schematically, the central temperature of some star as a function of time, there's two critical temperatures. Then there's the temperature to burn the lithium 7, which is around 3 by 10 to the 8 Kelvin. Sorry, 3 by 10 to the 6 Kelvin. And that ends up being lower than the temperature you need to have enough hydrogen burning to hold the star up. Okay, so that's just the coincidence of the nuclear physics, because this is of course the PP chain, and these are quite different. So if I follow, say, a star more massive than 0.08, it will at some point burn its lithium and then slightly later ignite the hydrogen and live at a constant TC. That's the main sequence. There's some other stars. There's a narrow range of masses where they'll burn their lithium but never become a star. Okay, that's for objects roughly between 0.06 and 0.08. And then there's a much larger range of objects that never get hot enough to burn their lithium 7, say this one, in which case the lithium is preserved. Sorry, I didn't say one thing. This is turning around at late times because of degeneracy. So the as the star contracts, when the electrons become degenerate, then to match the pressure of the contracting star, you do it with the Fermi energy rather than KT. And so the temperature, in some sense, gets free to do its own thing. And actually, it just evolves due to conduction, pretty much. Okay, so if you follow the trajectory of the central temperature of the star of 0.05 solar masses, that's what it looks like. And this coincidence is why people are doing all this hard work, is that this is a very good indicator of brown dwarfness. If you have an old star sitting somewhere over here, which still has its lithium, then you know it never got hot enough to burn its lithium, in which case it never got hot enough to burn the hydrogen. So it's a brown dwarf. Okay? And that's the reason, in some sense, that motivated a lot of the observational work, is that convenience. Okay. So the trick is very simple. You just basically presume that the star is always fully mixed, and that allows you to write down the integral for the rate at which lithium is being burned throughout the star. And as I said, the mixing time is sort of 10,000, 100 years, shorter than the contraction time. And that pretty much allows you to really do the full calculation. So let me give you the results rather than just, so I'm not going to show you the algebra. So it is more than just a time scale match. You actually really calculate it. And what you find is that as the following, this is now the central temperature of the star as a function of the actual abundance of the lithium, where the initial abundance is F naught, the present abundance is F. So this W is the logarithmic decrement of the lithium. And what you see is that the temperature at which you burn the lithium goes weakly with the mass, as I said, and weakly with the effective temperature. Okay. And so actually you fix a radius quite accurately because of this. The way to say it is that the virial theorem sort of fixes the radius. How long does it take you to reach that radius? Well, this is, again, the depletion time, the time at which you've depleted by, say, a factor of 2. And you can see it doesn't depend that strongly on this. It's the 10th root of the log. And the observers love that because they have a hard time getting the lithium abundance accurately. So the 10th root of the log of their measurement. So it's around 50 million years, and I'm just showing you the scalings. And just to make clear, there have been, of course, detailed numerical calculations of exactly this. And these formula recreate the tables to typically better than 3%. And actually found errors, but I'm not going to talk about who had the errors. Be a gentleman. People weren't happy. You can imagine the error you'd make numerically is that you have a very strongly rising function, and if you don't set your time step in your numerical code to the nuclear burning rate, you will just, you won't integrate it properly. And that's exactly what happened to a few people who we identified from errors in their tables. So it depletes very rapidly, and that's a big advantage. And let me give you a sense of a way to say how fast it depletes. So as I sort of show, the time at depletion goes as this 10th root of the log. So we could ask, what's the time difference between when it's 99% depleted and half depleted? Okay. And that difference in the time is only about 25% of the total age. Okay. So that gives you some sense as to how well the observers need to measure the lithium abundance. Can they tell between half of the initial and 99%? Yes, they can. And so thankfully, it actually is not that sensitive to the actual abundance level at the level of even factor of 5 or 10 estimates. So in some sense, it's an on-off question. It's better to just ask, is there lithium or not? And as I'll show you, that's pretty much what's happened, is that the observers either see it or they don't. All right, now this is a bit of a busy plot, but it also shows some of the physics a little bit. So what I'm plotting is the mass of the star, and on this axis is the central temperature. The zero age main sequence are these green lines. This is where you live on the hydrogen burning. A star, as it contracts towards the main sequence, is rising up on this plot. And these lines show where the elements get depleted. So lithium 6 gets depleted first. Here's lithium 7 going away. This is actually beryllium 9, which I'm not going to talk about. And at some point, this line, you start having nuclear energy from the PP cycle matching about 5% of the luminosity here, 50%, and you get the zero age main sequence. This explains why we don't study more massive stars. This boundary shows where the star is able to, at the core, transport the heat via just radiative diffusion. So when the star reaches, the central conditions reach this point, say, convection no longer reaches to the core of the star. And so that's why we only study stars on this side, below about 0.4 solar masses, because we don't want to worry about where this boundary actually is. Okay? In age units, and this is a little bit clearer, this shows you how things go with age. So again, this is now showing the age of the star as a function of its mass. So this shows you that a 0.1 solar mass star depletes its lithium at about 50 million years. Okay. A 0.08 solar mass star depletes it at about 150 million years. And I'm also showing you here the three clusters that I'm going to talk about today, the Pleiades, Alpha Persei, and IC2391. So this is the radiative boundary. This is the place we don't want to talk about. And so in some sense, it tells you if you want to play the age game, which I haven't explained yet, how you use this to date clusters, you want to stick to clusters between 10 and roughly 200 million-year-old clusters. You don't want to go too much younger. Also, accretion starts becoming a problem at 10 million years. But you don't want to go much younger. You don't want to go much older because actually it's all over by then. Okay. And the thing to be sure is clear is that this exercise, the observational exercise of dating a cluster this way, was first carried out by Bosri, Marcy, and Graham in 96 for the Pleiades. And that's what got this started, was their observations looking for brown dwarfs, but indirectly they actually got an age from this technique, and I'll explain that. Okay. Let me just actually go to that right now. Here is a color magnitude diagram of the Pleiades, and this is not even the up-to-date stuff, but this just shows you straight away the observation. So here's the zero age main sequence. So this is the I magnitude, this is I minus K. So again, the less massive stars are coming down this way, and these are the more massive stars. So the more massive stars that reach the main sequence, lower mass objects aren't there yet. And what you see are all of these objects here. They looked at, there was no lithium in their photospheres. And all these objects, this one, and this one, all have lithium. Okay? So there's a boundary, a sharp boundary. And that's what was used in the original paper, actually from this object, which is now known to be a brown dwarf binary, this is actually two stars, that was used to get the Pleiades age, as I'll show you. So this is sort of wetting your whistle. I'll show you many more plots like this. And as you can see, these are pretty faint objects. And so you actually need Keck, which is why it's happened just recently. How do you get an age? Well, let me explain how you get a limit to the age. And it's rather simple. So let me first explain how if you find a star which has no lithium in it, you actually get a minimum age. How does that game work? Well, if the lithium has been depleted, then the temperature, the central temperature, has exceeded some number, that 3 by 10 to the 6, roughly. The core has gotten hot enough that it's been able to burn all the lithium. That tells you that the mass over radius has exceeded some number from the Virial theorem. But actually, for open clusters, we know what the radii of these stars are. We know the distance, we know the luminosity, so we know the luminosity, and the effective temperature is hopefully observed. Okay? And in that case, then, you know that the mass exceeds some number. Just giving you the walkthrough argument, right? So we know what R is, so we invert that. However, if it's this mass and this radius, we can also ask, it takes a certain amount of time for a star to fall down the Hayashi track and get to that radius. That's roughly, again, I'm just schematically showing you, that's roughly the gravitational energy, gm squared over r, divided by the luminosity. Okay, as you can see, this thing goes like m squared, so if m is bigger than some number, then the time, the age, is bigger than some number. Okay. So here's an example that shows it. Here is a star in the Pleiades called HHJ3. It has no lithium, so it's a lithium-depleted star. And on this axis, we're showing the mass of the star, and on this axis, the age, or the time. And for this star, what you find is that the fact that it has no lithium means it must be older than 100 million years and more massive than 0.08 solar masses. This is the allowed region. For an error bar on the luminosity, this is the luminosity in solar units, and for the measured effective temperature. Okay. So from that one star alone, you know that it's older than 100 million years, and we know it's a member of the cluster. And we presume they're all born on the same day, at least in the 10 million year time scale. There's another object, and I'll show you more of these, called CALR3, which is an object that has lithium still in it, so you invert these arguments. You turn all the arguments around, it hasn't burned its lithium, so the mass is less than something, and it's younger than some age. And what you find is then is that this is the allowed region. For this object, this is also in the same cluster. And so the combination, in this case, this is the old data, I'll give you the current numbers, it says that the Pleiades is between roughly 200 and 100. So this is, that, for those two stars alone, what you already get. Okay. Okay. All right, that was what the state of things was 3 years ago. This is, I'm going to now walk you through this game and how it's been played for three different clusters. By different groups. Here's the current state of things for the Pleiades. These are actually different stars by Stauffer and company. Again, what they're showing you here is the color magnitude diagram. This is the zero age main sequence. Stars that are filled have lithium. Stars on this side have no lithium. So again, they've seen the boundary. When they play this game, they get an age with an error bar in this case because they have stars close, 125 plus or minus 10. For IC2391, same game, color magnitude diagram. Here are stars without lithium. Here are stars with lithium. They find a well-defined boundary. Again, the age they get from that is 53 plus or minus 5. And the last one is Alpha Persei, which looks like the following, except they changed their color scheme. So these have no lithium. Sorry, see, I get it wrong. These have lithium and these have no lithium. They just swap the same authors. I complain to them. Again, they find a very sharp boundary. Okay, and the sharpness is just sort of what you expect. As I said, it's an on-off experiment. And this gives an age for Alpha Persei of roughly 90 million years. So where do things stand? So if you look at these three different clusters, here's the situation. Here are three clusters. Here are the ages from the lithium burning. And what I'm showing you in the right-hand column is what I'm calling the traditional age. And what I mean by that is what you'll find in your textbook. The age of the cluster, if you pull up some old book, Okay, and I'll go into the physics a bit of the overshoot. These have no overshoot, this is tight right now. These ages have no overshoot in them. Okay, and I'll explain what I mean by overshoot in a minute. Okay. So I'll explain it right now. How do you get ages from the upper main sequence? Well, first let me tell you which stars are leaving the main sequence today. Roughly speaking, at 100 million years, it's a 5 solar mass star. And at 30 million years, it's around an 8 solar mass star. So that just gives you a sense of the range. For these stars, the luminosity is a very strong function of the mass. It's going roughly as mass cubed. So actually, from the observations, there's very little uncertainty in what the mass is of the star, the turnoff mass. So the turnoff mass is actually not that uncertain. And just to remind you what the turnoff looks like, stars on the upper main sequence, as they're burning hydrogen via the CNO cycle, and evolve, pretty much move to the right, namely to larger radii.
And
that's what I'm going to say. So exactly. Yeah, that's fine. It's because of the CNO cycle is also very temperature sensitive, means that to match the luminosity, the central temperature is a number. So what happens as the star is burning hydrogen to helium, you're changing the mean molecular weight. And that's also in the virial theorem. And so to keep the temperature constant with a heavier mean molecular weight, the star has to expand. Okay? This is Leon said much more succinctly. There's a dependence of luminosity on mu. That's right. That's a little more subtle because that depends on the amount of heat transport in the core versus the envelope. That's right. So there is also a luminosity dependence on mu. But that one, that you never see the simple back of the envelope scaling. And that's because of the fact that it's the envelope mu that matters much more than the interior mu, the burning mu. Okay. Now, the problem is the following. These stars have a structure, which is as follows, a vigorously convective core, okay, and a radiative envelope. And the time you spend on the main sequence depends on the amount of mass you get to burn divided by the luminosity. And the mass you get to burn depends completely on where this boundary resides, because this is fully convective in the interior. Okay. So what convective overshoot is allowing some of these convective cells to penetrate out into the radiative envelope, grab more fuel, and bring it into the stellar interior, thereby increasing the age, increasing the time the star gets to burn.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
The structure is so well known that one has to appeal to overshoot to modify that radius?
No. Okay, so I said too many things at once. So the radius increase, you don't need convective overshoot for that.
The radius of convection.
No, so let me say, there's a degeneracy with the opacity. So again, that boundary, where that boundary is, depends on the opacity of the material. So if you think you know the opacity, and that's changed, those two are potentially degenerate in the sense you can go and change the opacity willy-nilly and get rid of the need for convective overshoot. As I'll just tell you now, well, I'll get to it in a minute, so remind me, because it has changed. There still is a need for it with the new opacities. The need's not as severe as it was with the old opacities. Okay. Okay, so what does the convective overshoot do? So again, if the convection halts where the temperature gradient is stable, then the way to say it is the mass of hydrogen available is much less than if there's convection overshoot. And so overshoot does the following. It leads to longer main sequence 5 times. It leads to, and this is Leon's point, when more luminous stars at the terminal age main sequence, it does have that effect. So this is an observable that's already been observed. And it actually, later on in the evolution, leads to shorter helium burning time. So there are already observables in the upper main sequence that might already tell you a hint that there's a need for convective overshoot. And the numbers for that analysis, a number say from Manet et al., was for the Pleiades already 100 million years. Okay? So let me already make clear that there was evidence for convective overshoot and the need for it from the upper main sequence data, and the age inferred was 100 million years. Okay, already longer than the textbook age. Okay. Yeah?
Why does it need a shorter helium burning time?
Because you have, let me see if I can get this. It leads to, boy, did I even remember this. The helium core is more massive when it ignites, but I don't actually know why it's a shorter time. Definitely have a more massive helium core than you'd predict. There's also evidence for that from Cepheids, that there's a more massive helium core than you'd expect without overshooting. Maybe it's just the luminosity. Yeah, it could just be, that's probably it, actually. They are more luminous, and so the helium time's shorter because it has to burn it more rapidly. That's probably right. Ellen, did you have a...
Okay.
Let me give you an example, just in the HR diagram, what these look like. This is... These are plots showing, here's again the zero age domain sequence, here's a five solar mass star. This is for no overshoot. The overshoot is defined in the following way, and it's a recipe. It's defined as the convective zone is allowed to go some fraction alpha of the scale height above the boundary. The boundary being defined relative to the Schwarzschild criterion, where this is just the local scale height. Okay, so that's the definition. And that's just what put in the codes, and you let it run. And again, you can see already the issue I was saying, that the turn-off, the terminal age mate sequence is further as you go to overshoot. And this is, they are brighter. Okay, they are brighter. And this just gives you a sense of what happens to the upper main sequence. So what are the ages with overshoot? Okay. So this is from different papers. There's a let me skip the HR diagram and just give you the numbers. This is in a paper by Ventura et al. With an overshoot parameter of a quarter, Manet et al. With an overshoot parameter of 0.2, and this is all with the new opacities. So actually, I cannot find a number for this one for some reason. So, you know, I haven't done it. For Alpha Persei, the number they had found was 80, and for Pleiades, 120. Okay, so these are two independently gathered data sets. Okay. So, and is striking, and it's sort of too good to be true. But this gives you, I think, reason to be confident that there is some convective overshoot, is what I would say. And that's sort of the message I wanted to give to people, is that without this independent age date, you could basically argue until you're blue in the face. But I think it's getting much harder to argue against it, because the lithiums are all coming out high. Okay. So any other impact on anything else? Well, there's one other thing that this impacts, and it's the white dwarf initial final mass relation. That's what I want to close with. And then leave time for questions. There are white dwarfs observed in open clusters. And because of that, you can actually get the cooling age of the white dwarf. You know how old that white dwarf is from the Nestel cooling law. Sorry, you got to be blamed for something. Okay?
Well,
it still does well. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. And you use that age then. So the idea is the following. If I tell you the cluster is 100 million years old, and we have a white dwarf that's 50 million years old, fine, you run it back in time. The white dwarf left the cluster when the cluster was 50 million years old. You use that then to get the mass of the star that left the main sequence, right? And so the age of the star that made that white dwarf is just the difference of the cluster age and the white dwarf cooling age, and that absolutely affects the mass, the inferred mass of the progenitor star. And if you ask observationally, how do we know what mass stars make white dwarfs, it's absolutely from the clusters. This is where this information is gathered. So it's very critical, and actually it's clear there was already a problem with the age of the Pleiades. The star that was there, the white dwarf, had a 50 million year old age. That's pretty robust. The textbook age of the Pleiades is 70, so you could start getting worried that, you know, these numbers are getting close. So let me just close by showing you the state of things. And in some sense, I usually show this more to the observers to make them embarrassed at how little work they've done. Because in the Pleiades, there is one white dwarf. And this is the mass that's been measured for that white dwarf. It's around 1. And the initial mass is inferred from the game I just explained. Okay. And there's the point. Okay. So this is for Pleiades. These are objects that are in older clusters, Hyades and Persepi. And these you're not going to get new ages on. These clusters are old. so you're not going to actually improve the situation. There is, however, another cluster, NGC 2516, which is a cluster like the Pleiades in age, which has four white dwarfs. The mass has been measured, and the inferred mass for these is actually from this has not yet had a new age. So this is, I sort of show this, as I said, to the observers to say, go out and get the lithium age for this one, and go in the Pleiades and do some more work, because this survey was 1972. This is Romanshin and Angel, from those who know. So the cluster ages are actually critical to the measurement of the masses of these white dwarfs, and you can see in this case for the Pleiades, this is from Neil Reed's work, he was using the overshoot age already. But you can see the problem that people were running into. The conventional age was 70, so that would have meant it was 20 million years old, and you get even a higher mass, initial mass. For that star, I think it's unambiguous. It's in the Pleiades. It's been studied for 20 years. So there's quite a lot known about it. But you know, you'd like to have more than one. It might just be the IMF doesn't give you more than one. But. Okay, so let me wrap up. You guys usually have two-hour meetings, so I thought I'd be kind. So hopefully I've made the case that the physics of the lithium depletion in low-mass stars is well understood. The observers can use the detection of this boundary to date these young open clusters. And not only is this robust, but it's likely replaced the traditional upper main sequence methods in the sense that it's actually much more robust theoretically and has pretty much made clear that convective overshoot's occurring. As I said at the end, the future work on this cluster, NGC 2516, is going to hopefully improve the white dwarf initial final mass relationship. And another final point to make is just to remind you of what motivated the observers to do this, was that roughly in clusters that are 100 million years old, stars that will never actually ignite to hydrogen are about to deplete their lithium. Namely, the mass of the brown dwarf, the mass below which you're a brown dwarf, is about 0.08, whereas the mass at which you deplete lithium is 0.06. So any star that you find in the field, some old faint object, and it has lithium is a brown dwarf. It's just unambiguous. Okay. And this is the point that really is why the observers work so hard on this. And I hope as brown dwarfs get passé, people will go back and start doing dating of clusters, which is, I think, potentially more interesting. Okay, at that point I'll stop. Almost all of the objects I showed you have H alpha and emission, and are, when you can measure it, rapidly rotating. So these objects for which the lithium measurements are made are almost always, sort of young coronally active stars.
But for the more massive stars, mm-hmm. if you use the same H,
yes.
And
okay. Yeah, so if you look at let me back up. So if you look at Pleiades, you look at, as you're saying, the more massive stars and look at the rotation as a function of mass, say, right? Or more importantly, look at, say, magnetic activity. You definitely see a fall off. I mean, you can definitely see correlations as the rotation rates decline in those objects, the magnetic activity dies. And what hasn't really been done yet is the loop needs to be closed on fixing. So when they compare one cluster to another, you'd like to find that all clusters are the same, right? And when you map one age onto another, that you can see the evolution. And what I haven't actually seen yet is a redo of comparing these different clusters with the different ages, with the new ages. So that just moves things around. I mean, there were some discrepancies with some of the younger clusters, in the sense that, you know, a cluster that was supposedly twice as old, things weren't spun down as much as they should have been, in that sense.
I had an elementary question. How do you know the white dwarf cooling? Like, how do you know the age of the white dwarf?
They take into account crystallization. Perhaps
not letting down from the upper stairs, the white dwarfs, mm-hmm. basically a crude, naive, 21-year-old calculation. Assuming pure radio transfer, carbon capacity, must be sophisticated or anything. But the results turned out to be remarkably similar.
Right, that's right.
I was leaving 10 years ago. Has there been any change?
Not really. Not for these ages. For old white dwarfs, there's an issue, but for this age, there's not much. The way you say is you can connect the white dwarf structure of these ages is very simple. It's an isothermal core, okay, and then there's the atmosphere, the outer layer, and the outer layer provides all of the thermal conductivity or the opacity for the exiting heat. And so basically, you can relate the flux going out to the central temperature. And that tells you then how to relate the luminosity of the star to its current temperature. And you know what the heat capacity is as a function of temperature for the white dwarf. So you can just write down the time evolution equation.
The white dwarf is very effectively lagged by the non-degenerate envelope. And so its capacity is high, basically cooling. And further in, you want a very high conductivity. And that's because of the temperature is supposed to be constant.
I thought there was this point that the bigger the white dwarf, the smaller it is, and so the longer it would take to cool. Is that at a much later stage? So, like, I thought
the mass does enter in.
Yeah,
the mass does enter in. Yeah. So there are scalings with the mass.
If you were to,
so
I thought though that the time for these white dwarfs to cool would be billions of years.
So let me tell you, give you a number. So 10 gigayears, they're about 10 to the minus 4 L sun. Roughly. So I don't know for Pleiades. I didn't look up the number, what it is at that age. I don't know how bright it is.
So you're basically just taking on how far it is, increase the luminosity, and that tells you.
Yeah, you can actually relate the luminosity to the age. The mass is in there, but you can actually measure the mass from the line broadening, from the pressure broadening of the lines. You actually get the mass independently. And in that case, actually, there's also gravitational redshift measurement.
Do you know what the status of human seismology constraints on the overshoot of the sun? Is that
anything? Yeah. He was talking about the overshoots from a core.
Right.
But because of the sun, it's from the
right. I agree.
But seismology puts some constraints on the jump in the temperature gradient below the convection zone. And this can be related to the old overshoot. But you really have to know. You have to know something about that overshoot in order to invert that. But it seems that the overshoot is much smaller than you can predict by
a small fragment scale.
A fraction of scale. Whereas in the laboratory experiments and all kinds of instruments can do, it's more like a pressure scale. So there's a puzzle there.
Yeah.
And maybe foundation, which is responsible for less overshoot, and that would be also responsible for less overshoot.
Yeah, I didn't say that here, but the eddy turnover. If you just write down the flux is rho vq, uses very efficient convection, and ask them what's the eddy turnover time on the core. That's actually we just did it the other day again. It's a long time relative to rotation. So the convection probably is modified by convection in these cores, and there's really been not much done on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
stop while you're ahead. Yes.
But you see, there are all of these things like this, which could extend the
right
rotation of these things.
Yeah.
The interplacement.
Right.
You cannot